Hi, welcome to Cloud Cover. I'm Ryan Dunn.
And I'm Steve Marks, no relation.
Hey, we got a great show this week. As always, we're going to have a three-part formula. The first part is going to be we're going to be talking about some news, the happenings that we have in the blogs, as we like to call them. Additionally, we're going to have our feature this week is going to be on the Blob API and how to generate those shared access signatures. And finally, we'll wrap up with a tip of the week, and in this case, it's going to be on how to easily create those shared access signatures yourself. Can't speak.
All right, so what are the haps? What are the happenings in the blogs? First up, we have the Snipshot blog, which is a blog by one of my coworkers on the Windows Azure team, Matodi. And Matodi has a blog that explains the ins and outs of upgrade domains and fault domains in Windows Azure. Not a lot of people know in great detail what these are. They may have sort of heard about it if they looked at some of the Windows Azure Fabric internals and some talks on that. But this tells you exactly what those things mean, how they keep your service up and running, how they help you to upgrade your service, what impact they'll have, and what you can do or not do about them. It has cool, awesome visuals. So if you want
you're talking about this little
learn,
slide.
That's what I'm talking about, absolutely. The long tail. So check out that blog post if you want to read those details. It talks quite a bit about what those things mean. And so for folks who are curious about it, go to the blog.
Spoiler alert, fault domains and upgrade domains, they're important.
Mm-hmm. And not the same thing.
No.
Spoiler alert. All right.
Okay.
Let's move right along to handling the 40552 error in SQL Azure. So this is a blog post by a member of the SQL Azure team, whose name I'm not going to try to pronounce.
It's actually a bit.ly link. You could look up at the top. It's blogs.msdn.com.cbiyikoglu.
Yep.
That's something we randomly generated, actually, in order to
absolutely
to define
new blogs.msdn URL shortener.
It's Jihan.
40552 is the error that you get from SQL Azure when you do something that looks kind of like a denial of service attack on your own database. So if you are doing a lot of transactions, you will get this error message back from SQL Azure. It basically says, stop it. It looks like you're trying to attack this database. This blog post has a couple of tips about how you can avoid getting into that situation in the first place. Mm-hmm. And the most important one is really sort of towards the bottom about specifying online equals on when you do a create, alter, or drop index. And that basically, instead of doing one giant transaction, which will just hammer the log, it breaks it up into little mini transactions, has better results for concurrency, and will help you avoid this error. So if you're seeing that, check out this blog post. It describes why that happens and how to fix it.
Right. Great. And next?
DigiGirls.
Yeah.
DigiGirls is some sort of event in Australia. That's as much as I gleaned from this blog post. But what the cool thing and the Windows Azure thing about this is this blog post that describes a deep zoom project on Windows Azure for this event, where it basically takes all the Flickr photos that are in the group for this event, pulls them together, runs Deep Zoom Composer on them, using Windows Azure drives, because Deep Zoom Composer wants to use the NTFS file system.
Right.
So using a Windows Azure drive to get that on top of durable storage. Then finally stores some of the output in blobs and has a web role that serves up some Silverlight control that uses Deep Zoom to access the blobs. It's actually kind of cool. It touches a lot of different pieces of the platform, as well as Link to SQL, WCF RIA services, and some other stuff. Unfortunately, the code is not available right now. So you've got the blog post to go read and learn about the architecture, but this isn't a code sample that you can go download and play with yourself.
That's very cool, yeah. And now Eugenio Pache. Eugenio, actually, as we like to butcher his name here in the U.S., he actually works in the Patterns and Practices group, and he's leading up an effort to build the Windows Azure guidance. And this is kind of the thing that we've heard from a lot of developers on, you know, what are the best practices, how do I get my app up and running if I had something working on premises and I knew how to do it there? What is the transition path look like when I want to bring it up to the cloud? And all those kind of learnings in there as well. One of the things that Eugenio has been doing is a series of blog posts on that entire process as it goes along and some of the aspects that they're looking at. In this case, the application lifecycle management. And what I would say is to go out and take a look at, in general, at Eugenio's blog. It's a fantastic resource anyways. But you'll find that he comes in and he actually likes to diagram out a lot of the patterns that we're seeing and some of the best practices, or at least some of the ideas that he has in his head as we're starting to develop this guidance. And if you feel strongly about this, you know, that there's a better way or anything like that, you know, you can always leave a comment to Eugenio here in his blog. And it's one of those things where Eugenio is very good about taking that feedback, incorporating it. But at the same time, this guidance that we have here has actually been generated by a lot of experience of folks who've been running this themselves. So go ahead and take a look out on Eugenio's blog here on MSDN. And look at his pretty pictures and get the gist of how we're developing this entire guidance going forward.
Yeah, and I want to remind everybody that we'll link to this blog post, but go look at the blog and just sort of scroll down, because this blog post is actually the last in sort of the past week or so that's about the Windows Azure guidance stuff.
Yeah.
There are about four or five more before this that cover different topics. So,
yeah.
So even if this isn't the thing you were looking for, make sure to check that out and see all the blog posts that he's done.
This one in particular is talking about application lifecycle management. So how would you do deploy to production testing? How do you deal with the live IDs? How does an administrator have a build server and all that process? But there's much more in his blogs,
yeah,
in other details as well.
Great content. So this is from the Windows Azure team blog. This is about upcoming support for .NET Framework 4 in Windows Azure.
Mm-hmm.
It is not there yet. So this is about the .NET 4 RC. We've put that in the latest OS build that's released for Windows Azure. So if you deploy a new application now and don't specify anything, that's the OS build you'll pick up. If you have an older application, you can go in and change the OS version string to point to this. So you can pick up this OS build. It has the .NET Framework 4 RC in the build, but you can't use it. So you can't deploy something that uses .NET 4. We will only launch .NET 3 and 3.5 applications now. And so the reason that it's in the build is this is just preparation as we get ready to roll out the RTM once that's available. So this is the preparation step. Do note this one little gotcha that's in this blog about using the generic ASP.NET performance counters.
Right.
They'll always pick up the latest version, and since .NET Framework 4 RC is there, they'll pick up that version, which means you probably won't see the logs from your application. So best practice is to really use the versioned performance counter strings. If you notice anything else that's different after you've picked up .NET Framework 4 RC, let mm-hmm. us know, because this is how we're preparing to put the RTM version into the product.
Right. And it's important to point out here as well, I mean, as part of this news, that we are going to be putting the RTM of .NET 4 out within 90 days of the RTM, which was...
And sooner if we can. We're trying to do it as quickly as possible after RTM.
Absolutely, right.
But definitely within 3 months.
That's great. Okay, well, that brings us to the feature this week. So the feature this week is actually on building shared access signatures. Shared access signatures is a way that we can, without using the master key, we can actually share blobs, or in some cases containers, to other third parties and give them access for puts and reads and writes and deletes. In order to talk about this, I think it might be beneficial to spend a little bit of time at the whiteboard and kind of diagram out what the different components of that shared access signature are. And then I'll drop into some code and show you how easy it is to actually generate this using our storage client today. Okay. The most important thing to think about here is that shared access signatures actually work on URIs. So if you think about the URI we have in Windows Azure, you think about something that looks like this typically. So you have the account name here, and then you have blob.core.windows.net. Okay, at this point we have one of our main identifiers, which is the account name. It's the starts of the DNS here. The next thing we're going to have is we're going to have some sort of container identifier, or in the case of root container, it'll be implied with a $root. And then finally, anything after that is going to be considered the blob resource or the blob name. So I'm putting these in angle brackets here to say, you know, this is the piece that you're going to be filling in, not that you need to enclose this in angle brackets. It's just in case anyone was wondering. Now, the important thing here is the normal operations, if we did a get, a put, a post, a delete, or anything like that, is we would be putting a header, a signed header in here that was our authorization header. That authorization header is generated by canonicalizing this resource, the operation that you're going to do, and other things, and actually signing that with the master key. Now, on the flip side, the storage service is going to get that. It's going to look at the time, it's going to look at the operation, it's going to canonicalize the resource itself, and it's going to determine what that hash should be as well. It knows the master key as well. Now, by comparing those two hashes, we know whether or not that's a valid request. So all we've done here for shared access signature is we say, well, let's put the signature in the URI. So what we'll do is we'll put the permissions, we'll put all the operations that we want someone to be able to do, and we'll just put them on the end of the URI in a query string. How this works. So there's a few components to this. We have something called assigned start time. So it's an ST. If you imagine this is everything after the query indicator here, and this is a key value pair. So the ST is really the start time. This is going to be a date time format. You can look up the specific format itself, but it needs to be formatted properly. Then we have something called the signature expiry time, or the end time. This is when you want the signature to expire. Now, the important thing here is this is required. You absolutely have to specify when something is going to expire. So this is your expiry. This is optional. If the start time is optional, if you don't supply that, we're just going to assume in the most common case that you want it to be valid now, which I think for about 80% of our developers is going to be the case. Very uncommon to have a future forward-looking URI. Anyhow, the expiry time, however, must be specified. Next we have something called assigned resource, in which case we're going to either choose a blob or a container. So in this case, if we applied it just as we have here with the question mark at the end of the blob string, we would always have a SR equals blob, because we're saying we're going to have this operation apply to the blob itself. Now, if we had something just at the container and we started it right here, in this case, then we would have container. Now, the difference between these is there's one additional operation you can do on a container that you can't do on a blob, and I'll get into more about that. We also have assigned permission. This is what you're going to let that URI or let that user of the URI perform on this given URL, which is you can have a read, a write, a delete, or if it's a container, you can have something called list, which simply allows you to then list the contents of the container itself. Now, once you have these components in here, you're actually going to be able to construct most of the URI. The final bit that you have to have is something called the SIG. So the SIG is just the hash, the signed hash of this canonicalized resource with all of these parameters in here. When you specify this on the URI, the storage service will take it, take a look at it, it'll calculate what the signature should be, and if they match, it'll allow you access, just as if you passed it using the normal way of using the headers within the HTTP request itself. Now, there's a couple caveats here that you should be aware of. When you specify all five parts of the signature using this, these signatures could potentially be pretty, I don't want to say dangerous, but it could have some potential for leakage. So let's assume that you specified some very long expiration, which I'll get into later that you actually can't, but let's assume that you could. What would happen is if we allowed you to do that, if you say you had a 2-month expiry here and you had read, write, delete to the container, read, write, list, delete to the container, you'd essentially be giving full control to that container to whoever had this URI for as long as this thing is active according to the expiry. Now, if that was to leak or it was somehow to be compromised to someone you didn't want using it, this would be a problem. The only way to mitigate this would be to actually change the master key, which would in turn invalidate that signature. Now, that's a problem. You don't always want to be changing the master key, especially if you have applications that rely on that master key or are currently working using it. So what we do is if you specify a 5-part signature, This is actually a max of 1 hour. So by default, if you put all five pieces in here and you wanted to use this and hand it out, you could specify at most 1 hour from date time now, essentially. This gives you a smaller window where people can't mess with your stuff if you accidentally were compromised. Now, if you look at this, you say, okay, this is great. However, what if I want to do something longer? I want to have an expiration that's like a week longer. Or let's say, 1 hour is even too much. If I were to lose this URI for an hour, and I wouldn't want everyone hitting this or posting stuff into my account for that hour. How can I have control over this and instantly revoke it or change it on the fly? And to do that, we have another piece to this puzzle, which is called the signed identifier. Now, the signed identifier you can think of as a template around these four pieces. So at any part in the signed identifier, you can actually specify the start time, the expiry with no limit. You can go as long as you want there. The resource level and the permissions that are going to be associated to it. Now, you don't have to specify all of them, so you can think of it as kind of a fill in the hole. If I were to not specify, I would create a signed identifier, let's say called read. If I create that signed identifier, I can then associate these four parameters to it. Let's say that I don't specify the start time, so it means it's instantly valid now. I do an expiration of 1 month from now, and I don't put in any permissions. What that means is if I go to apply this to a URI, all that my signature is going to have, remember, is I'm going to have my URI now, question mark, I'm going to have, I already specified the start time is optional within the signed identifier, so I'll have signed identifier equals read, I'll have my ampersand, I have the expiry in the signed identifier, I have the signed resource in the identifier. Now, I didn't specify the signed permissions. So here is where you would actually have to specify that because it's one of those required attributes. So I would need to specify signed permissions equals read, something like that. Now, the reality is most of the time you use these signed identifiers, you actually specify all of these. This would also have, of course, the signature because you're still going to canonicalize and sign this URI itself. However, most of the time for the signed identifier, you're going to actually take a template of these four properties here, and you're going to say, look, I'm going to create a read policy that's good for the next month, and it's going to apply to all blobs in this container. And you might apply that to the container. You have to apply the signed identifier to a container, I should say that. For signed identifiers, they're a policy that's applied, saved with the container. So therefore, you are going to save this and then associate it to the container. Anyhow, the point here is you're going to create this template, and it's going to allow you to fill in the blanks. I'll show some code here, and it'll make a lot more sense when we get into that. Now, with all of these pieces in place, at the end of the day, you could actually give someone a signature that looks something like this. You could say, here's a URI to a container. The signed identifier is read-only. Ampersand, here's some signature. And it's going to be some big value that's calculated a signed hash. That's all you would supply to someone. And based on the policies that you created for that signed identifier, which are properties here, those permissions will apply. If something were to leak now, if this URI were to leak and it had permissions that you didn't want, you could either do one of two things. You could instantly revoke that, just delete the signed identifier, it's gone. No one can use it anymore, or you could go in and actually change it, keep it the same name, but change it and have it expire maybe quicker, or maybe change the permissions so that it's list only instead of read. You can do all of these things by changing the signed identifier itself. So a very powerful way for you to quickly be able to react just in case you were to lose control of this URI itself. Now, to show how this works and how easy it is, I'm actually going to step in here and write a little bit of code. Now, I'm using LinkPad here. I'm just going to throw together a few quick snippets. I don't need a project. You don't have to run this in Windows Azure Cloud. This is something you can run from a command line console. You can do anything you like here. So the first part of this is I'm going to need to, in order to generate this, I'm going to need my own credentials. So I've just saved them off to the clipboard here. And what it looks like is we have a storage credentials account and key. So you give it pass the name and you give it the master key or the secondary key as the case may be. And the next thing you're going to want to do is you're going to actually want to create the blob cloud storage account. I should say, if we look at this particular we look at this particular sample, it actually we reference a few things in here. We reference the storage client library, obviously, and we've pulled in a couple namespaces. So the Windows Microsoft.Windows Azure namespace as well as the storage client namespace. And that's where all of this functionality lives. And the reason you want to pull in this one in addition to the storage client is there's some extension methods that have been defined that help you do things very easily. If you don't specify that, you wouldn't see those extension methods. So once we have this, we actually want to get the cloud storage account. So we can create the account. Var account is a new cloud storage account. And you pass in either the credentials themselves or the different endpoints. In this case, we're just going to pass in the creds. Next, you're going to create the client. So I'm going to create a client here, and this is just simply an extension method that's been defined called create blob client. And once you do that, it lines up to the right endpoints. It takes it, obviously, it points to the Dunnery, in this case, blob storage account. Now, a very simple thing to do here as a demo is I'm going to generate a shared access signature for every file in the storage account. Now, if you have lots and lots of files, don't do this in practice, but it makes a great demo, right? So the first thing I'm going to do is get the list of all the container names in my account. So I'll say containers is client list containers. And I need to get the name of these. So in this case, it's c.name, I believe. Yeah, there we go. This is actually going to select all of the names inside the account. Excuse me. For each one of these, for each container in the container's name sequence, I'm actually going to get a reference to that container, and then I'm going to enumerate all the blobs in there. So in this case, I'm going to say, client get container reference and the container name here. This gets me a reference to that container. And now in the container, I'm going to enumerate each one of these. So for each blob, let's call it B in container. List blobs. I'm going to list all of them. And in order to deal with if you have directories and slashes in here, here's a little trick. You can say new blob request options. And you can actually specify use flat style listings, use flat blob listings. So set that to true. And now when you do this, you're actually going to list out each one of the blobs in the container, but you're going to kind of ignore that path. If you didn't do this, it would give you, if you had a slash in the name, it would give you the first part as a cloud directory, in which case then you would need to enumerate. So we use those slashes sometimes to make kind of a hierarchy of names within a container, even though they themselves are not containers as such. So anyhow, now I'm going to loop through each one of these, and what this gives me back is actually not a blob per se, so I need to cast it as a blob. So I'm going to do var blob is b as cloud blob, something like that. Now once I have this, the casting won't fail here, but for defensive programming, right, you always want to say if blob is not equal null. Now once you have the blob, it's simple. You say blob get shared access signature, and here is the bit that you need to specify. So in this case, you'd say new shared access policy, right? New shared access policy, And then there's some stuff in here that you're gonna specify in terms of parameters. Oops, let's try this again. And these things are like the permissions themselves. So here we say shared access permissions. I'll just do read. If you had multiple, you would obviously OR them together. But I'll do read, and then I'm gonna do expiry time is date time now. I don't know, do 10 minutes, say. So for 10 minutes from now, this will actually expire. Now, once I have this, this is pretty much it. I have that shared access signature policy done. I'm going to use a feature out of LinkPad. I'm just going to dump this to the actual console here. So if I run this and everything works, does it work? No, it doesn't. Let's see. Error parsing query does not contain. Oops. It needs a true here, or a false in some case. So the overload it's looking for is whether or not to use HTTPS. If you usually you want to put true here, use HTTPS. However, if you're doing something like I am and you want to use Fiddler, say, and kind of inspect what was actually happening on the wire, it's easiest just to turn off HTTPS, and that way you can attach Fiddler very easily. So anyhow, I missed that. Let's try it again. Take a few seconds here to generate all of these because I'm looping through every container and every file in the container. I don't have that many, however, so it shouldn't be too bad.
So while this is going, this is an example of not using an identifier, right? This is the,
yeah.
I'm going to specify it all. So the max expiry time you could have set is an hour.
Yeah, the max here is an hour. In fact, if I specify more than that, I believe it will generate it for you. However, if you were to try it, actually put it on the URI, like a GET request, for instance, it would give you an error back from the service. So what you see here is I have all these different signed identifiers. Maybe I'll export these to Excel. It might be easier to look at. But I could take any one of these, in theory, and pop it into the browser and actually try it. So maybe that's worthwhile doing. Try this one. I don't even know what it is. Oh, I'll have to find out what the URI is, actually. So this is just the query, right? So what we want to do is we want to actually dump the name of the blob as well. So let's do that. So we'll say blob dot path and URI dot path and query plus, let's use this whole thing as a string, and here we go. We have the signatures coming back. In this case, here's a one to the root jellyfish. Let's try something that's small-ish. Let's try this one. So I'm going to highlight this whole thing, copy it. I'll bring up, let's create a new tab. And it's HTTP, remember, dunry.windows, or excuse me, .blob.core.windows.net. And then just paste this in, make sure I didn't add extra slash, I did. Paste that in, and if within 10 minutes this should work, and in fact it does. Yep. So it's saying, hey, do you want to read this icons PPTX, which I don't in this case, but you see that it actually works. Now the other bit of this that you probably are interested in is how to create those signed identifiers, and that's actually very, very simple. So the first thing to remember is that you're working with containers in this case. So once you get your container reference here, on the container, you can get the permissions, and the permissions themselves have shared access policies on them. So it stands to reason that you can actually create this yourself as well. So inside the shared access policies, there's like a key and a value on here. But what you would do is you would create, var si is new shared access policies. And then you would say var si1 is new shared access policy. And you would define it just like we did before, with some expiration and what it applies to and all those different things in here as well. So you would put all these things in here. And then you would add this into the collection, so si.add, and you would add that si1. So you're adding one of those policies on here. Now you can have up to 5 of these policies on a particular container, and that allows you to have, you know, it's like version for Steve, one for me, here's a public read one, here's the super secret delete one that I'm not going to give out, or I'm going to have a much tighter window on, but allows you to define up to 5. Once you create this, what you'll simply do is, at that point, is you'll say, you know, container set permissions, and it's going to look for, if I can type, it's going to look for the blob container permissions, and inside of these blob container permissions, you'll see that it actually has new blob container permissions. Let's take a look here. It has... Let's try it this way. I'm not getting what I want. So let's do a new blob container permissions b equals new blob container permissions b dot shared access policies. You would set that to SI, and then you would do container dot set permissions. And you would add this B into it. So that's basically it. This is how you define it out. You get the reference to the container. You create a list of policies, which are multiple of them. You stuff your policies in. Then you add it with the set permissions to the blob container permissions. And that's,
don't we need a name for this? There needs to be a name for this, right? Where do you set that? Is that on...
You do, actually. The shared access policy, not the shared access policy, I'm sorry. When you do an add, this would give me an error. It's actually a two-part signature. So if you look here, a string key. So in this case, it would be like read.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, that's a mistake. So here's where you put it. You would say, shared access policies, read. Here's that policy, and you should associate it. It's a dictionary.
And when you create the, so if I were to create the query string that maps to this signed identifier, mm-hmm. it's, I'm guessing, I don't really remember what the API looks like, but I'm guessing there's just sort of a, there's a property off of that. When I was setting the different properties, I assume that one of those that I could have set is use this signed identifier for this query string. Okay,
right,
and then it packages up. So it doesn't really change that bit of the code. If you're going to use signed identifier, it's just that in place of those permissions, you just put... Yeah. Sign identifier equals my read in this case. Right.
So all of this is in code. You can obviously do this very easily yourself. I've very sloppily done this in just a few minutes, right? I'm no Steve Marks, by the way. You notice I used IntelliSense, and I made mistakes when I typed.
Weak.
Very weak.
do we want to talk at all about, like, maybe just a couple... use cases of this, you know, just why do people use this?
Yeah, absolutely.
I've seen this. The one place where I actually noticed, it's not that they're using Windows Azure for this, but they're using this kind of thing, is TwitPic. I found a picture on TwitPic. Mm-hmm. I meant to copy the actual image and save it and put it and post it on my blog in a blog post, but I accidentally did a deep link because I just messed it up in the editor. And everything worked fine, blog post looked great, and like 10 minutes later, you look at my blog post and there's an error.
Right.
And it's because TwitPic actually puts permissions, you know, in that URL. It's not quite the same as this, but it does it. And so it's a way to control access to things that are like public, but you want to control the experience. You want people to come to your site to see it, so you don't want deep linking. So that's one place people have used it.
Yeah.
It's also a way to avoid funneling things through your web role. So if you've got a big video and you want someone to play it in a Silverlight player, you don't necessarily want that to have to go through your web role and to the Silverlight player. Okay. So sometimes you might just set it as public, set that whole container to public, and anyone can do a GET. But if you want to do authentication or authorization, that way you can mark the blob private, but you can use a shared access signature that you deliver to the client, where then they can go straight to blob storage. So this can save you on
It's a way to scale out your blob storage. So if you look at photo galleries or anything like that, where you have people uploading stuff to your service, One way to do it is to write a web role that accepts the file.
Yeah.
The other way to do it is to deliver to them a client. It could be Silverlight. It could be something on the desktop. And instead of giving them, actually taking the binary itself, give them a shared access signature that says, here's the name of the blob that I've pre-created for you, essentially. Go ahead and put that in this location, and you have a 25-minute window or something to do that. That's an easy way to do it. And also, this is an easy way for any client that doesn't understand how to use the authorization headers to actually be able to read back data that would not otherwise be public.
So even if you
were, as the user, were that person, and you had like a, I don't know, maybe as a JavaScript client, it could be Silverlight, it could be anything, and you wanted to just read back files, but you didn't want to have to create those headers, or it was a pain to do that because of some limitations there, you can actually use this. And once you get that, I mean, it's just a URI. It's just a get. You saw that I pasted it into Internet Explorer, and it just downloaded it, right? So easy way to do. Well,
cool. Is it that time?
I believe it is that time.
I think it's getting to that point of the show, and we need a little bit of setup for this one, because we're not going to be here for the next 2 weeks. We're not going to be doing cloud cover shows for the next 2 weeks.
Hiatus.
We're a hiatus, and the reason is, I mean, it may not be clear to everyone at home, but we have a staff of writers for the show who script every single word that we say on the show.
Yeah.
And so when you think we're being spontaneous, you know, impromptu kind of things we throw in there. No, even every typo Ryan had in his code, that's actually scripted.
Well,
by
I'm not actually typing this. We have someone backstage.
We do. So our staff is, I mean, each show, you know, it costs us about $30,000 to produce because of the wages we have to pay to the staff members. And $30,000 isn't enough, apparently. So our writers have decided that they're going to go on strike. And for that reason, somehow we know that after 2 weeks, they're going to come back from the strike.
Well, the makeup artists are going out with them as well, and I heard through the makeup artist guild,
they're ready to cave.
They'll cave in 2 weeks.
Okay, so 2 weeks is all it's going to last, but that's the length of the writer's strike. And so, I think to introduce this tip of the week, we should probably see, you know, what that writer room looks like and the writers for this show. So, with that, it's time for the tip of the week.
Hello.
So this tip actually ties in with the feature, right? Because you just saw all of the code that Ryan did to whip this up. It's actually not a lot. But if you just wanted to do this because you want to just create this, Ryan actually does this all the time. When he wants to send me a link actually to this show, when he's previewing, we've got the show ready to review.
Funnily enough, here
he sends me. He sends me a link with a shared access signature.
See all the different movies here? I have my Cloud Cover 7, which was the last episode. So whenever I want to send something to Steve and say, hey, check out the last episode we have, here's the proof, as it may be. What I do is at the videos level. So the first thing I should point out is I'm in my Azure storage in the Blob browser. I've just logged in as that Dunry account, so you can see up here that I'm at the Dunry account. What I have is some containers here, and in the containers I have obviously my files. In this case, here's the videos. Well, what I've done is I've gone in and I've set up a signed identifier. So if you look at the manage policies, I have created what I said before, which is a read policy. You'll notice I did not specify a start date. I specified an end date, which expires here at the end of the month, and I said read only. I gave it the name read. So when I do this, it means that I can apply that policy to any of the files in here. In this case, I'm going to take the cloud cover, and I'm going to say share, and I want to say apply the read policy to this particular file. And you'll notice that there's no start date. I don't need this again. But these are grayed out because I've filled in all of the holes, all the non-optional holes. In this case, it's the read access and the date time. So when I do a get URI, if I actually launch this, it's going to go ahead and it's going to launch our last episode. Now, funnily enough, I've already seen it, so I'm going to go ahead and stop that right now. However, this is how you generate that. If you look at this URI, so I'll do a copy shortcut and put it up in here. And you'll see that this is simply what it is. So let's take a look. Whoops. I'm so good with this keyboard today. Let's take a look using Zoom It, because it's probably worth a quick look. We have the dunnery.core.windows.net videos cloud cover, and you'll see the sign resources blob, sign identifier is read, and the signature then is that big long sign string. And that's it. That's all I had to do, and I use this every time. It allows me to give you a URI that lasts for longer than an hour and allows you to download the video on demand. In fact, this link is actually good until the end of the month. If you were to copy it down very quick, you could watch our video again.
Including the part that you can't read because it's not on the screen. Then you'd be good. Cool. And My Azure Storage is a bigger tool than this. It's not all it does. It does a whole bunch of manipulation of blobs and tables.
And queues.
And queues, even. I didn't even know there were queues on
here.
I gotta go check that part out, too. So this is a good tool. This is actually, your team owns this tool, right, Ryan?
Yep.
This is yours, so this is a safe URL. Don't get scared that that someone is stealing your credentials or something. It's us. We're the ones stealing them.
Yeah, I should probably put a better link on here. I mean, at the bottom it says Microsoft, but it's like in gray. I don't know why I did that.
Yeah,
I need to bump that up a little bit.
So a good thing to check out is just one alternative to how to manage your stuff, and this actually helps with the shared access signatures. So that's a pretty handy thing.
Right.
Okay. So. Great. With this, we are going to see you guys at the end of the month, because the next 2 weeks, the rest was a joke, but really for the next 2 weeks, we're not going to be doing the show, so we will be back after that hiatus. In the meantime, you can still send us tweets to @CloudCoverShow, because we both keep that up and look at that and respond to things. So, so please do that, and we will see you in a few weeks.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks.